So, yes, so firstly, thank you, Vidyadhara, for a full and warm introduction. I really appreciate that, yeah. And really lovely to see all of you. Many faces I know, and it's just well, it's just great. Thank you for coming, and faces I don't as well. So, yes, a warm welcome from me too. So, so 40 years ago, this centre was opened. Bante Sangharakshita, to the founder of Tri Ratna, he launched it. There were two ceremonies, one for this shrine and one for the other one. I think they had 10 days of festivities. Probably a ribbon or two was cut, and tea and cake, I'm pretty sure, lots of it. And really, the centre's grown so much since then. I mean, I wasn't around, actually, at the centre at that time. I was alive at the time, as you probably guessed. Actually, how many of us were alive 40 years ago? Even if our infancy. Okay, good. And how many of us... let's see, how many of you are in your 20s or 30s? Okay. Okay, good. I'm glad to see that. Good hope for the next 40 years. And actually, was anyone actually there? Yay, David Mitchell. So he'll no doubt correct me. Feel free to correct me along the way if I get things wrong. But the LBC has grown hugely since that time, and it's now a place where we have several meditation classes a day, yoga classes, we have parents and children's events, we have arts and cultural events. There's a couple of businesses associated with the LBC. There's Lamas, the charity shop, Jambala Bookshop. What else is there? We do secular mindfulness. So there's a range of activities that go on here. Really, you couldn't, we struggle to count everything that goes on at the centre, actually. So we're celebrating all of that. We're celebrating really how the centre's grown in terms of its activities. But we're also, more importantly, I think, celebrating who we've become, really, as well. And I think you do that when you have a big anniversary or birthday or celebration. You sort of look back, and you look back at the events in your life, the things that have happened and the things you've done, but you also really have a sense of who you are now as a result. The sort of how you've changed over time. So we're celebrating both those things, the sort of the achievements, the successes, the range of things that we've done over the years, but also who we are now as a result of that journey that we've been on. So, and we take stock, don't we, when we have a big event like that. We take stock and we go, what have we learned? What have we learned over that time? And, who are we now? And what does that mean for the future? So in a way, having sort of done some reflection when we have this sort of big event, we sort of look to the future and we try and make some sort of imaginative, creative, intelligent intentions, aspirations, wishes for the future. So in a way, I'm hoping that over the next month of celebrations, we have a whole month of celebrations, which is good, that we'll collectively and individually be able to look back at the past and then sort of begin to look towards the future and individually and collectively make some wishes for ourselves and for us collectively, intelligent, imaginative, creative wishes and aspirations. Even though, of course, none of us know what's going to happen. We don't know what the future brings. So I've been, in thinking about this talk, I've been doing that, sort of just looking back and beginning to look ahead. And I'm calling this talk Miracles and Maelstroms. I'll talk about miracles first. So it has a few definitions, and the obvious one is something supernatural, strange, unexplained. There are those miracles, of course, in the Buddha's life and in the Buddhist tradition, but I'm sort of not so much using it in that sense today. I'm using it in the other definitions, which are these. Miracle, a remarkable event or development that brings very welcome consequences. An exceptional product, thing, or achievement, or an outstanding example of something. a wonder, a marvel. So when the centre was launched 40 years ago, I think it was as a result of a number of, or even numerous, miracles or remarkable events and developments, which I think produced very welcome consequences. The consequences of us being here in this room is one of those. So for me, one of the first, when I thought about this, in fact, I've thought about this often. I've often sat there meditating at lunchtime or an evening, and I thought, how did I get here? You know, in Bethnal Green, in this centre, with everyone else. I think that is something to wonder and marvel about. And particularly, I sort of actually grew up, I was born in Mile End, and grew up, my first house was in Roman Road, off Roman Road Market. You could hear the market on a weekend. For me, and at that time, the Bethnal Green and Ireland, and in East London generally, was a very grim place, hostile actually. I experienced it as very hostile, and I couldn't wait to leave. In fact, I decided about the age of six that I was going to get out of this kind of place and not come back. So when I didn't actually discover Buddhism at the LBC. I was in another city at the time, and I knew that I wanted to go to the. I'd heard about the London Buddhist Centre, and I knew that I needed to be there. And I was very shocked, in fact, to discover it was in Bethnal Green. I was like, you know, the Bethnal Green that I'd left, you know, many years ago. So actually, the first wonder is the fact that the London Buddhist Centre is in Bethnal Green. So you might think, those of you who are younger, go, well, it's a lovely place, it's Victoria Park, and this is. But actually, at that time, this was not the place that you would have chosen to have a Buddhist centre. It actually had quite a reputation for crime and criminality, and the Craze brothers were local and etc. So that is a wonder, I think. And I think the another wonder is the fact that it got built, this place. For those of you who've read the magazine, our last magazine programme, you'll see that there were some articles by Sabuti, who's our president, and was the first chair of the centre as well. Yeah. And he describes that there was a group of middle-class arts students, basically, or graduates, who didn't know how to hold a screwdriver, who decided that they were going to renovate this disused, it was a disused, vandalised fire station, listed building as well. And they decided they were going to, renovate it. And they managed to persuade the local, well, it was a local council, but also it was the mayor's office, the equivalent of that as well, to let them do it. I really don't know how they did that. Attila, some of you know Attila, he was the one of only one or two skilled people, apparently, in the team. And he became the foreman, and he describes the project as hell. So, I can imagine. I can't imagine it, actually. I'm trying to imagine what was it like with people who were all, they were all mostly under 30 as well. So young, idealistic, inspired people who were going to renovate this place. But they did it. And, that is a marvel. You know, you look around now, you think it's still standing after all those years. And they got through the project. And it really wasn't easy. I think they had a lot of tough times. And Sabuti he was the sort of the team leader. He was the one that was sort of motivating them, I think, very much each day. Attila was trying to teach people basic skills to get it done. But yes, it is a wonder. And they were all inspired. So although they lacked skills, they actually had a lot of faith and commitment, and they had vision as well. So that's kind of encouraging, isn't it, that you can sort of lack some things in some areas, but if you have faith and sort of confidence and vision, it can take you quite far. So So Tree Ratna was formed about 10 years prior to the building of this centre in 1968. So, and obviously Bante Sangharakshita is the founder of the centre, and he really much, he really did inspire this project. Really, in a way, although there were other centres that had been created at that time, this was the first big project of Tree Ratna. So in a way, it felt like actually lots of people came to support the creation of this place. It was the biggest undertaking of the day. And he apparently would come and give talks he was teaching the Dharma in the way that he'd always done, but he was really, really relating it to their experience. So they were able to hear the Dharma quite differently because they were all engaged in this project. And one of the things that he emphasized was the spiritual community, the importance of the spiritual community, which he probably had done before, but somehow, if you're engaged in this big project and you're having to really, you're coming up against yourself, you're coming up against each other, you're having to get something done, suddenly you're going to hear his teachings on community in a very personal kind of way. So he talked about the spiritual community, and he talked about it as being the heart of personal and societal transformation. And this centre was originally called Sukhavati, which means pure land, a land of bliss and peace and love, where everything's in harmony and where everything reminds you of the Dharma. Everything reminds you of how you can grow and develop. So I just think that's worth contemplating, even for a moment, what that's like. Imagining that wherever you go, that there's something that would help you connect to your values, help you connect to your value, and help you connect to and inspire you to grow. I think that was the vision. And eventually, well, people actually began to live whilst they were still renovating the place, and eventually residential communities sprang up and businesses sprang up as well. And at one point there were about eight different businesses around the LBC. So we had health centre, we had two cafes, what else did we have? We had a housing association, which was how some of the residential communities were managed. Lots of different businesses. And so in a way here, around this area, it felt like a Buddhist village. You sort of go shopping into your friend's food and get your health, you get your, you know, your whatever it is, your oats porridge or whatever, and then you'd go to get a treatment at the Body Wise, and then you'd go and do something at the art centre. Everything was reminding you of your what you held true, what was valuable to you. So we don't have those businesses, many of those businesses now, but we have a thriving centre, and who knows what the next sort of 40 years might bring in terms of new initiatives like that. But what we're doing, we're celebrating all of those activities, all of that growth that's happened over the years, and we're celebrating this community, this spiritual community. People coming together really and inspiring each other to practice, and then creating the conditions, whatever they might be, whether it's a shop, whether it's a house, whether it's a study group, whether it's a new class, creating the conditions whereby that meets people's needs, where people can grow. And Bante was very much emphasising that. So I think over the years, the London Buddhist Centre has really grown into a very broad community. I think at certain stages, it was very much, in a way, those people who were really engaged in all those sort of activities were sort of at the heart of it. And now we have a heart of the London Buddhist Centre, but we're very broad as well. And I really like the fact that we're broad in that way. So we have people coming who, you know, are just really simply curious. You know, what is meditation? What is Buddhism? They pop in, they learn, they do a course. They like the atmosphere. I might be describing you if I'm saying this and you can nod. But, you know, you like the atmosphere. It makes you feel good when you come, and that's enough. You know, that. So we have people like that, and then we have people who come regularly, year in, year out. We have many people volunteering in different ways, and obviously volunteering all kinds of different ways, from giving a talk, running a retreat, to being at reception, etc. And then we've also got people that spend their whole lives here as well. You know, like there's communities up there, upstairs, so people live here too. So it's a really very broad community. And it's also, there's lots of different levels of commitment as well, a lot that goes along with that. So again, from people who, wanting to learn to meditate and that's enough, to those who are actually giving up their whole lives to practicing for their own benefit and for the benefit of others. So I came along to this centre because, I started off my life in my Buddhist life in a small centre, and it was a very friendly place, and I sort of made good connections there. But I knew it wouldn't be enough for me. It was small, there wasn't many young people there, and there weren't anyone of colour there, and there weren't any experienced women there at the centre. So at a certain point for me, I thought, I just need to be in a more diverse place. I need to be in a place where I can choose what activities I want to do, but also meet different people. And I think that's... for me, it was really spiritually very important, because I was getting a sense that I was changing as I was practicing. And it was early days, so I thought, what will I be like after practicing for 10 years and 20 years and 30 years? I had no clue, and there weren't any women, at least, around who I could sort of look to and go, oh, you still look okay, you know, which is what I was probably worried about. I sort of wanted reassurance that actually the path, I wanted reassurance and I wanted confidence. I wanted reassurance that the path would be okay, and I could travel it, and I wanted confidence that actually it was worth traveling. And so for me, I needed to be around, you know, more experienced people, people that really did have, I could sort of see how, you know, just see them really and get a sense of how they were and what practice looked like 10, 20, 30 years down the line. So that was really important for me. What was also important for me was knowing that there were different people that practiced and different characters and personalities. What's really interesting about the Dharma, when you practice it more and more, is how with other practitioners you feel more like you've got more in common. So you begin to, I wouldn't say speak the same language, but you could begin to resonate much more. And so I can go to a Buddhist center, you know, somewhere I've never been, and make very instant connections with people that I've never met before, because we share values. We share values, and that's expressed in a certain way. And that's an amazing thing. And at the same time, so you've got that on the one hand, there's a sort of coming together, a sort of commonality, a real communication. And at the same time, it's like you become more and more yourself. I think it's maybe as one's, you know, you let go of your conditioning that sort of constrains you. As a result of that, what comes into being is more of your own intrinsic sort of qualities. And so you become quite different as well. So in a way, you're sort of becoming more alike and more different at the same time. And that was a really... So I was beginning to get a sense of that. I sort of thought, I don't want to... I know I'm not like everybody else, so I don't want to be like everybody else. But they are a bit similar, the Buddhists. There is something similar about them. How does that work? And how do I not lose myself? How do I become more like myself? That was really sort of important to me. And so for me to get a sense of that, I needed to be around more in my diverse sangha, where I saw different personalities. And certainly I experienced that straight away. I could see there was somebody who'd been practicing for a long time who seemed really mindful, and I thought, that's great, but I don't know if I'm that mindful like them. But then somebody else would be really sort of a extrovert, and I thought, that's great, I think I'm a bit more like that. So I was able to sort of gauge different ways of being, and then think, and then realise, you know, relax, you know, I'll just grow into my own nature. And it's a bit like, you know, you see that in nature, don't you? You see that the trees have this intrinsic, they have the commonalities, but every tree is completely unique and different. And I needed to be around a more diverse Sangha for that. And the LBC absolutely provided that. We still, of course, could be more diverse, I think. And certainly in our next 40 years, that's something that I very much wish will be there. So that's a wonder there. Another wonder, Bante, you know, he was born and brought up in Tooting. He became a monk and found himself in India and met these many prominent teachers. So he had access, many of them were Tibetans, and he had access to the Tibetan teachers because there'd been the Chinese invasion of Tibet. He was there when many of them were fleeing. And he had really many of the legendary teachers of the century. And he had one in particular who I want to mention. I just want to bring, you know, his presence in the room, if you like. And his name was Dado Rinpoche. And he had a particular influence on me when I heard about him. I've never met him, but I heard about him. And he was known as a living bodhisattva, someone who works as intent on enlightenment for their sake and for the sake of all beings. And what I particularly loved about hearing about Dado was, firstly, he meditated for several hours in the morning and at night. He taught the Dharma. But during the day, he ran this school for Tibetan refugees and orphans. And he always seemed to, I got a sense when people were talking about him as just having a lot of joy and creativity and resourcefulness. It was the first time actually that I'd sort of encountered somebody who very much was working for the benefit of others, but was enjoying themselves fully at the same time and was teaching others how to live well, really. So it was this sort of... that sort of coming together of altruism and wisdom and joy. And that was really the first time I'd sort of seen that and experienced that, at least hearing about him. So he formed a very strong friendship with Bante. Really, it was his example of what a bodhisattva is that really really inspired Bante and really has continued to inspire this movement and this centre. So that's something that we're going to come on to this in terms of communication, because they had a real sort of living communication. Dado Rinpoche sort of embodied the qualities in a way you saw through him the potential of practice, the potential of many, many years of practice and dedicated practice. And Bante was inspired through that. And obviously he was inspired through his other teachers as well. Another wonder is the fact that through Dada Rinpoche, through Bante's other teachers, through Bante, we have at the centre a direct connection to the lineage and right all the way back to the Buddha. So I sometimes sit here and think, gosh, I know Bante, and he knows people who actually, if you followed the line, would take you all the way back to the Buddha. And there's been this sort of unceasing communication that's gone on between teacher and disciple from that time that we're still benefiting from. So there's a wonder. So, I'm going to do one more miracle or wonder, and then I'm going to get onto maelstroms. So, actually, since I've mentioned the Buddha, let's go to Siddhartha. Siddhartha the prince, before he became the Buddha. I always, I could really relate to Siddhartha and his questions. I think, you know, we have people like this coming to centre who's actually, life is good, yeah? You know, they've got good jobs, things are going well. But there's just this question, isn't there, of, is this it? Should I be happy now with what's going on? Is there more? Should I be trying to find more? Or should I be content? And in a way, I think that's where Siddhartha started off. A kind of, well, he was wealthy, he was healthy, he had a lovely wife and child. In a way, that should have been enough, but it wasn't. I hear people like that all the time coming to centre and going, I just was curious, you know, is there more? So then that leads him outside the palace gates, and he goes in search, and then he gets hit by, well, really assaults, but of the truth. He sees a sick person, he sees an old person, and he sees a dead person. And what started off as a sort of curiosity, really, like, is this it, becomes a deep existential crisis. And again, we have people like this coming along. You, again, might recognise yourself, you know, who's faced with sickness or somebody dear to you. You're trying to deal with age or the passing of time, change, or, of course, loss in all its various forms. So I think we can relate to Siddhartha in that regard. And, of course, then he sees the fourth sight, where he thinks, oh, maybe there is a way, and I need to go on the search for that. And of course, I also hear people go, well, they're only here at the centre because their friend, colleague, boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife told them to go to the centre, to learn to meditate, to, you know. So in a way, you know, we are fourth sights for each other as well in that regard. So, yeah, so we know he leaves everything behind. We know that he learns the mindfulness of breathing, and he excels in that. And then we know that he has these dangerous years of asceticism and really not looking after, you know, his body in the pursuit with an idea, really, of what that will get him. But he doesn't get him very far. And, of course, then he attains an enlightenment, which is the miracle, if you like, of the Buddhist tradition. So he sort of absorbs his experience of enlightenment over a number of weeks. And then this question, or some say doubt, occurs. How am I going to communicate this? How am I going to communicate this experience or this understanding or this revelation in a way that others will not only understand, but able to put into practice? So yes, he goes in search of his previous ascetic followers. It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because I think in part of that is like the Buddha knew that he wasn't unique. You know, he was unique in finding the path, in uncovering the path, but he knew that actually what he'd done was uncover the nature of mind. It wasn't unique. And yet how he also knew that the journey to that enlightenment or the journey to that discovery was going to be challenging because it was so different to how we normally relate to ourselves and other people. So there's this challenge, but he goes off in search of his ascetic friends, and they don't want to greet him at first, but then they do, and he teaches them, and then the moment happens. So this is it's the key moment in the Buddhist tradition. It's the moment where spiritual sort of community and communication all comes together, because it's only at the point where he communicates to his ascetic followers, and Kundinya, one of the ascetics, says, the Buddha realizes that Kundinya knows, he's understood, he becomes enlightened. And the Buddha, you have this sense that the Buddha's really full of joy. Kundinya knows, Kundinya knows. And the reason that's significant is because that's the only way, actually, through communication, through transmission, that we really do get a sense of the truth. We can read about stuff in books. We all have done that. We can practice ourselves individually. We can all do that. But how do we know what's actually been realised? It is through interaction, communication with others that we begin to see where we are, and in a way that's a part of the significance of spiritual community and communication. And obviously Kundinya was ready for that transmission, he was ready for that truth, he'd been prepared and he was receptive. So we have to do our work for that to happen, for communication to really land, for the truth to really land, but we have to do our work to do that. So this sort of communication of truth is really what the LBC has been doing over the last 40 years. Yes, we've been doing all these activities, but the reason behind that is to communicate truth, communicate value in a way that that others can understand, realise it for themselves, and bring it into being. So I hope, in the next 40 years, that is what we're going to continue, that we're going to continue to grow various different activities to meet the needs. But really what we're going to do is continue to really begin to understand the truth for ourselves more and more deeply, embody it so that it can be communicated, not just in words, but in who we are, who we've become individually and collectively. So, yes, maelstroms. I didn't actually know what a maelstrom was, but I dreamt about them. So I'm going to tell you the some dreams. So there are a series of dreams I had over a few days, weeks, and this is the first one. I'm in a market. There's lots of hustle and bustle. I'm buying things. I'm talking to people. And it's a sunny day, and then suddenly it becomes cold and grey, even dark, and the wind starts whipping up, and people start muttering, there's a maelstrom, they begin to flee. That's the first dream. I ignore it. Strange dream, ignore. second dream, I'm at an order gathering, lots of other order members. Somebody's giving a very inspiring talk. It's a sunny day. Then it goes dark, goes cloudy, it's cold. Somebody says that maelstrom's coming. We have to get to safety. So at this point, two dreams about maelstroms. What is a maelstrom? Actually, it's a tidal event. So I don't know, I was looking up at the sky, there's all the dreams, but actually says it's something that happens in the sea. So that's strange. Anyway, in my dreams, it was the sky. and it means it's a tidal event, disturbance in the sea. It also means confusion, chaos, turmoil. So these are the final dream in the series. I'm outdoors at an order event again. We look up at the sky, we know it's coming, the maelstrom. Someone says we need to get to the centre. We arrive outside, but there's many ahead of us. And as I get to the door, I'm not sure they're going to let me in. I hear someone say, they're only letting in the teachers now. I don't know if I qualify. But they let me in. So once in the centre, the scene is really beautiful. So they've got this chaotic scene outside. But in the centre, it's completely beautiful. It's immediately calm, immediately peaceful. And the centre's huge. It's like much bigger than the centre we have now. It's huge. But it's still very recognisable, the London Buddhist Centre. And I go down to the basement. And in the basement, there are these men and women, people just sitting there, and they're in robes. And they're sitting there shining. They're literally shining. I know, without anyone telling me, I know they've been on a very long retreat or they've been doing very intensive study of some kind. They just have that energy. If you've met someone who just come back from being ordained, they have this energy about them. And you could tell that these people have been on retreat or they've been doing intensive study, and there's a peacefulness there, there's a bliss there, there's a joy there, but they're serious as well. So that's the first level. Then I go upstairs, and there are people sitting in armchairs talking to each other, having cups of tea, the usual sort of biscuits, etc. It's quite a relaxed atmosphere, but there's some serious conversations going on as well. I go to the next level, people are making tea and food and things like that. Another level, there's artwork, there's people are reading, poetry being recited. Another level, there's people on computer tablets typing, quite industrious kind of level. So I think this is great. I love this, you know, because I can, whatever mood I'm in, I can sort of go to any of the levels, really. And I find myself sitting there and Subuti's, the president is there and I'm talking to him about some article or something like that. So everything's great. And I think I can just stay here. And then my stomach lurches because a maelstrom's outside. I know that. And my son is out there. So I have a son, a teenage son. And what am I going to do? I've got to go and get him. And at the same time, it's dangerous out there. And it's dangerous out there, and he needs safety. So that's how the dream ends, with me facing this dilemma. So at the time, I had this dream a number of years ago, and I sort of interpreted a particular way at the time. But these dreams, when you sort of have them, they sort of stay with you for a bit. And it suddenly, it came to mind again when I was thinking about the 40th celebration. So that's kind of interesting. And I thought, well, actually, our centre's huge. The fact of the matter is, we've pretty much outgrown the London Buddhist Centre in the 40 years that we've now had it. So actually, the centre does need to expand. We don't know how that's going to happen. We actually do need some miracles for that to happen. But in my dream, the centre was huge. It already expanded. That's one of my wishes, actually, for the next 40 years. In fact, the next 10 years, that this centre expands in some way. But anyway, I love the fact in the dream that the centre has lots of different levels. The basement was interesting because the basement, usually the basement's dark, isn't it? And people don't really like going down to the basement. It's like the depths of something. The basement really represents the depths. But in these depths, there was light. There was illumination. And in fact, it was the depths that really powered, really sort of inspired and gave energy to the rest of the levels of the centre. And I think that's really significant that you know, you can have lots of different activities, but actually, unless it's coming from depth, unless it's coming from light and energy, then it just becomes busyness. It just becomes another organisation doing things. They were being powered by these people who really were dedicated to the truth. And the fact is, we had food. We had in the other aspects of the centre, there was food, there was poetry, there were other things that were nourishing us. So we need to be nourished in our sort of spiritual life. And that's what that represented. And there was also communication happening as well. People were, you know, writing on computers and things like that. So again, we need to communicate. So all of that felt very whole. And I just thought, yeah, that's great. But then there's this challenge, isn't there, at the end of the dream. My son is outside. He is not at the centre. And you could interpret that in a way he represents someone who one cares about. And actually, we all have people. Like we can be practicing, we can be growing, we can be learning to live a life of value. We have people in our lives who we care about who still might be struggling, yeah? Still might be needing to find their way. How do we relate to that? How do we engage with that? So I think that's partly of what he represents in the dream. And I think he also represents the fact that it's my son and not somebody else I care about. I thought, well, it's because I've got a responsibility. You know, when you have children, you have a direct responsibility. You can't go, oh, somebody else will sort that. I know they're struggling, but somebody else will do that. And I kind of thought, well, that represents the fact that, well, in a way, the more dedicated we are as Buddhists, the more we've benefited from the teachings ourselves, in a way that sort of indicates the more responsibility we have to reach out to those who, you know, are caught in confusion, chaos, turmoil. So one of my wishes for the centre over the next years is so that we can continue to, find the depths of truth and really understand the teachings fully, and at the same time, we can be outward facing. We can really remember that there are people out there who are needing the Dharma. It's interesting. I sort of, as you, some of you know, I did a Radio 4 program recently. What was interesting, I sent a few links to a couple of my friends who are not Buddhist, and they sent the links to a few of their friends. And what came back was that people knew about Buddhism. They knew about the Buddha. They'd heard about the Buddha. They'd certainly heard about meditation. They'd definitely heard about mindfulness. But they hadn't heard about the Metta-bhavana. And they didn't know that there was a way you could just systematically cultivate positive emotion. And that's a really, that's tried and tested. And I was kind of really struck by that. I was thinking, gosh, you know, we can take it for granted, you know, once we've been introduced to this, we can take it for granted somehow the information's out there if people want to get it, but actually not necessarily. What was interesting as well, people knew about the Buddha or heard about the Buddha, people knew about meditation or they'd heard about meditation, but one woman who's definitely wouldn't describe herself as spiritual in any way, she said, I sort of agreed with everything in that. I listened to it twice because I sort of agreed in everything in that. I used different language. I didn't realise I shared the same values and feelings as a Buddhist. And that's really important because I think there are people out there who just don't know what we stand for and therefore wouldn't relate or even think about coming to a Buddhist centre. So we have a responsibility. Those of us who have really benefited from the teachings, the more we benefit, the more I think we have a responsibility to sort of reach out. And I also think we have a responsibility to align ourselves with causes and things in the world that is alleviating suffering, that we can see clearly is doing that. And that's because it's important to alleviate suffering anyway. But also, we want a society whereby it's easy to find the Dharma. The more oppressive a place is, the more unjust a place is, the more conflict there is in a place, the harder it is for people to find their ways to practice. So we can align ourselves, without being political, we can align ourselves with things that are going to that are alleviating suffering. So 40 years ago, vegetarianism, for example, was a weird thing. It's hard to believe that, actually, but it was. But, you know, Buddhists, you know, mostly we're vegetarian. We probably started one of the first vegetarian cafes in London next door. So that was us just living our lives, but at the same time aligning ourselves with a growing movement of people that were caring about animals. For example, that's just one example that I think we can sort of all see. And society has changed as a result of that. So we stay connected to the world, we stay connected, we engage, we have some responsibility for the world, I think. At the same time, Buddhism teaches about the middle way, so we never, if we want to keep a tradition going, we have to follow the middle way. So at the same time, while we want to be more outward facing and not overly just concerned with our own sort of needs, at the same time, we also know that the world as it is has limitations, that it's not going to give us a freedom and happiness as it is. So, and actually what will give us freedom of happiness is sort of the finding the depths of the Dharma, really exploring the teachings. That's really where wisdom comes in. Compassion, real compassion, only comes as a result of wisdom. So we have to, as Buddhists, really understand what is distinctive about the Buddhist teachings. What actually is wisdom, and how can that help us alleviate suffering? It's that we have to have more and more confidence in that. And understand it more for ourselves so we don't get caught up in the world on its own level. So the next 3 weeks, as Vidyadhaka pointed out, we're going to be doing, myself and Nanav Archer, some seminars on the distinctive features of Buddhist wisdom that actually relate to the suffering of the world. So, what else? Yeah, so we have external maelstroms. Actually, also, what I want to say, I sort of really don't take it for granted that we have a peaceful place we can practice as well. There are places in the world not far from us where you can't advertise a meditation retreat, for example, without getting into trouble or the authorities getting suspicious of you. So, you know, that's the kind of thing where I think, well, let's make the best use of the conditions we have and not take what we've got for granted here. So we have external maelstroms, things that go on socially, politically, environmentally. And then we have our own maelstroms as well. We have our own confusions, our own turmoils that we go through. And we will make mistakes. You know, I'll make mistakes, you'll make mistakes, we collectively will make mistakes. You know, we're still working, we're still practicing. It's not an ideal spiritual community. It is a spiritual community that's moving towards the ideal, but it's moving towards the ideal, and that means that there's going to be times where you know, we make mistakes, but that's part of the journey, and part of the journey is learning how to work with that well. So actually, it becomes rather than a maelstrom, and we stay in the maelstrom, it becomes an opportunity for growth. So learning to confess, learning to forgive, really important qualities and skills and practices that we really need to embody, you know, as a community, as a Sangha. Learning how to deal with our own, you know, limitations and our own views that get in the way of growth. So even like ambition and status and envy, all these things actually cause little maelstroms in our own minds and cause conflict between others. So as a community, you know, we'll keep, but one thing I always find interesting is that it's kind of really joyful to practice with others. We need other people to practice. It's supportive, it's inspiring. We learn from each other. And at the same time, we come up against each other. We come up against each other because we have egos and because we have very fixed view of who we are and who other people are. And that's part of learning to practice, learning to navigate that, learning to, you know, how to work effectively when you've, you know, come up against somebody, there's a conflict. You know, that's part of what we're trying to do as well. So maelstroms don't have to be, one level they can be destructive, of course, but if we learn to work with them skillfully, compassionately, they become opportunities for growth. So where have we got to? Well, in a way, I'm seeing the next... I don't know if I'll be going to be here in the next 40 years, actually. I was glad to see some of you put your hand up for 20 or 20 or 30. Hopefully you'll be here and celebrating the 40 years. Some of you may remember even this night. Many of us won't be here. But that's okay. For me, the most important thing is that I'm living a life with others trying to bring into being, what does it mean to live a life of value? What does it mean to live a life that's based on truth? And we're seeing it manifest in small ways. You know, on retreat, you see that. You see at the beginning of the retreat, people are one way, I'm one way, and at the end, there's transformation. So in a way, I very much hope this centre, if we continue to live a life of value and in community, in communication with each other, working with the maelstroms that appear, because they will appear, but creating opportunities for transformation, creating those spaces for wonder, then in a way, that's all that matters. We just keep doing that. We keep doing that, and then it gets passed on to the next person, and then they do that, and then it gets passed on to the next person. And you know, before long, there's thousands upon thousands of people who are practicing. And in a way, that's how this centre will continue. It's that. We'll do all these different activities, we'll keep responding to different needs, but the centre will continue through communication, through community, through friendship, and through people who are really dedicated to practicing for themselves, you know, and for others. So that's all I want to say. Thank you.